Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. This evening, we are going to have Donna Wynette of Family, Friends, and Individuals for the Mentally Ill hosting the show tonight. There was a little problem with the sound, so I believe she's going to be calling back in. But I want to say that they're going to be talking this evening about mental health. This is Mental Health Month. So I want everyone to feel free to call in and or just listen in as Donna and her guests bring awareness of mental health issues. The guest tonight will be Lisa Bellotta, who has worked in various capacities over the years in counseling, education, and spirituality. She has two adult children and one granddaughter. Her formal graduate training was in infant parent mental health, and she has worked as a group therapist in a behavioral health hospital. She is trained as a trauma therapist, Ignatian spiritual director, MBSR instructor, and various forms of communication skills, conflict resolution, and mediation. Donna also will be having as another guest, Sue Capriano, who taught children with mental illnesses for 25 years. Sue will discuss how trauma many times spurs on mental illness. And the final guest of Donna Wynette is Annette Burke, and she will be speaking on the need for prevention and adequate resources at the onset of mental illnesses. I'm hoping that Donna will be on with us. Donna, are you on with us?
I am. Thank you, Leona.
Donna, I just introduced everyone. There was a sound problem, I believe, when you called in earlier. So the show is now in your hands. Thank you so much. And I'm going to mute myself. And if anyone comes on, I will unmute them if they are muted. Again, thank you.
Thanks, Leona. Okay. So hello, everyone. I'm very happy to be here to present some important topics on behalf of Mental Health Awareness Month. And before we begin, I'd like to thank Leona Brandau for this opportunity. She is a retired social worker, a loving mother, a hardworking advocate, and a talented podcaster. And she was generous enough to allow us to have her studio for the evening. And with that, I'd like to introduce our guests. And I would like to say our mental health care that we're discussing goes across the state lines, because one of our guests is from New Hampshire, one is from Massachusetts, and one is from Rhode Island. So we'll have various perspectives, but all relevant to mental health. And I'd like to begin by saying no one, and I mean no one, chooses mental illness. It can happen to anyone. So many families have experienced mental illness within their own realm, within their own families. So community needs to band together. We really need to take care of all who are affected. And that's our goal here today, a coming together of support. So I'd like to begin with our first guest, our first esteemed guest, and my friend, Lisa Bellotta, who is, a group therapist and a trauma specialist. So Lisa, take the floor, please.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Donna. So I'm going to spend my time talking about trauma. And I'll talk for about 20 minutes. And, of course, this will in no way do justice to the topic. But I really hope it will provide some useful insights and actually tools that you can take into your daily life. So first I want to just explain a little bit about what actually trauma is. So there are primarily two different kinds of trauma. The first kind of trauma is what we refer to as shock trauma, which is a one-time event. So say, for example, a car accident. The other kind of trauma is when the trauma is more ongoing, like developmental trauma or something where there's repeated exposure to a traumatic situation. So in order to understand what trauma is, we first need to understand some about the nervous system. Because trauma is a physiological process. So our nervous system is designed for our survival, both in terms of mobilizing our energy to move towards that which is life-giving, like food, shelter, belonging, and also to mobilize to protect us from threat, for example, physical danger, predators. It's important to remember that to a great extent, our nervous system and conditioning play a huge role in our moment-to-moment actions, despite the general belief most people have that we are consciously choosing all of our actions. So we think that we're, you know, that we're the ones who are choosing what we do. But, you know, when you really understand trauma and neuroscience, you really see how so much of our actions and choices is actually coming out of our conditioning that is below, that most people aren't even aware of. So in terms of how the nervous system works, the ideal state of our nervous system is relaxed and alert. So from this place, our entire being is present, and we are accurately assessing for safety. We're alert to opportunities and ready to respond to threat. When there is a threat to our well-being, our nervous system becomes activated for us to mobilize and respond to and overcome that threat. When we successfully respond to the threat, then our nervous system returns to a state of being relaxed and alert again. So I just want to go over that because this is the ideal scenario. There's a threat, our nervous system gets activated, we take action to overcome the threat, and then the nervous system returns to an alert and relaxed state. So that's the ideal. Now, what trauma is trauma is when our nervous system is activated by a threat but unable to successfully overcome the threat. In some way, the threat is beyond our capacity to successfully overcome. In this case, the nervous system does not fully return to a state of being relaxed and alert. So I'm going to kind of summarize that again. So in trauma, there's a threat. The nervous system gets activated. We're unable to overcome the threat. And then the nervous system does not completely settle and does not return to a relaxed, alert state. So in the ideal functioning of the nervous system, when there is a threat that we successfully overcome and resolve that threat, what gets laid down in our brain and nervous system is a sense of agency and confidence in our ability to keep ourselves safe, a general confidence in our ability to navigate life. Now, on the other hand, in the case of trauma, where there is a threat which we are unable to successfully negotiate or overcome, what gets laid down in our brain and nervous system is an incomplete response and an experience of lack of agency and an inability to navigate life. So in general, trauma is any time that the human organism has an experience of threat that they are not able to successfully resolve or overcome. Now, the brain and the nervous system are very, very efficient. It strives to automate for the sake of efficiency. So, for example, we learn to tie our shoes. You know, we repeatedly go through the individual motions of tying the shoes and over again, and that eventually we can tie our shoes in a very automated way without even thinking about it. So it's the exact same process for trauma. The automated response is a conditioning that will get activated the next time we have a situation that it in some way has some element of the prior experience. So, for example, you know, you can't see me, but I will just ask you to, like, raise your arm above your head. I'm just going to give you an actual example here. So if you raise your arm above your head, and if somebody, if you saw somebody raising their arm above their head and they were in a classroom, what would you think that that person was doing? What was the meaning of them raising their arm above the head? And I don't know if you're there, Donna, if you can.
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so I would say they were asking for help or eager to answer a question in the classroom, or
exactly.
In some way they're calling for attention.
Yeah, they're in a classroom. Yeah, I mean they're calling the teacher's attention.
They may want to say, "May I go to the ladies' room?"
Yeah, but they're trying to get the teacher's attention.
Okay.
So now, if you were on a street corner in New York City. And you're raising your hand above your head, if you saw somebody doing that, what would you think they were doing?
I wouldn't know if they were going to maybe strike me or somehow looking for attention.
Maybe you've been around this trauma stuff for too long, but someone on the street corner in New York City raising their arm at the curb, they might be flagging down a taxi.
At the curb.
And but if you were a child who's growing up in a family with an alcoholic parent who raged and, and was physically abusive, and you saw them raising their hand, what might you think that might mean?
Yeah, that was my first response because it might mean danger. And, you know, in New York City where there's so many people and not maybe feeling safe, that they would have that same reaction.
Right.
That
well,
they
actually,
might be
you're,
struck.
You're actually getting to my point.
Okay.
You know, because most people, if they were really on the street in New York City and they just – saw somebody approaching the curb and waving, you know, raising their hand into the street, they would probably assume that they were flagging down a taxi. But say that person who was the young child who as a young child experienced trauma and experienced physical threat or physical assault. And they just happen to be on the street corner, and somebody next to them quickly raised their arm, then they might actually be triggered into that memory of being assaulted as a child, because that's the way the brain works. It's that anything that is even close to the original experience has the potential to trigger that trauma. So that's kind of how trauma from the past can get triggered in the present. So another thing to understand about trauma is that no two people will experience the same event in exactly the same way. So two people can have the exact same experience, but one of them might be traumatized by it and another one may not be. And the reason that it all comes down to is how that individual is able to maintain some sense of agency. So the person who is not traumatized, probably as they experienced this, they were able to maintain some sense of agency. They were able to take some action towards overcoming the threat. They were able to focus on the parts that they have control over, their own thinking, their self-care, their self-talk. And most likely there was availability of support, and they could have that experience that to somebody else might be traumatic, but because of how they were processing it, they weren't traumatized. But somebody else might have the same experience and be quite traumatized by it. So this is something that is well illustrated in. Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, you know, because he really got very curious about people in the concentration camps and why, you know, they were all pretty much experiencing the same thing, but some people were really able to find a way to deal with it and find a way to keep their spirit intact and find a way to keep a sense of wholeness about them. And these are the people who survived. And then there were other people who just weren't, who just weren't able to, navigate that situation. So So I guess I want to just go back and say a little bit about how physiologically how we as human beings respond to threat. And there's actually kind of three lines of defense that we have in response to threat. And as human beings, our brain is more developed. So something that's very unique to human beings is that actually our first line of defense when confronted with a threat that we cannot handle ourselves is actually social engagement. We turn to others to support us to overcome threat. And that is unique to human beings. The next level of the nervous system's response, which we share with many other animals, is the fight or flight response. In this state, the more primitive parts of the brain take over, and the prefrontal cortex, the prefrontal cortex is a very highly developed, is highly developed in humans, and it accounts for our problem-solving skills and higher thinking abilities. So when we're in the state of fight or flight, the more primitive parts of the brain take over, and the prefrontal cortex literally shuts down. So we don't have access to our problem-solving skills and higher thinking abilities. When we are in fight or flight, literally, we cannot do effective problem solving. Because our culture is so focused on the thinking mind, most of us spend many wasted hours trying to do problem solving to shut down prefrontal cortex, which is physiologically impossible. And for in the final line of defense, which we share with pretty much all living organisms, is freeze or collapse. And this works quite well if you are a possum or if you're a child growing up in a highly physically abusive environment. So for example, for a possum, you know, if they've determined that they're not going to be able to effectively fight and they're not going to be able to leave the situation, then they go into freeze, and so they pretend that they're dead, and so this works quite well because then the predator doesn't want to eat a dead animal, so then it'll just go off on its way, and then the possum is safe. And it's kind of the same thing with a child growing up in a highly abusive environment. I mean, you know, that might be the child's only choice is to freeze, to totally shut down. You know, any protest, any attempt to defend itself is not going to be successful. So it just has no other choice but to shut down. So basically, some of the important hallmarks of trauma are lack of agency, isolation, lack of effective thinking process, resulting in beliefs that are limiting and ineffective. So Fleet Mall, some of you might know of, he actually was somebody who was incarcerated for many years. And while he was incarcerated, he meditated a lot and did a lot of spiritual practice. And then when he was released from prison, he really has spent his life helping other people and helping other people, you know, see how they can be free. And so he made this statement that I thought was very interesting and very good when he said that individuals who are incarcerated have one main problem, and that is that they don't have very good problem-solving skills. And, you know, as we know, many people who are incarcerated have had significant trauma histories. And from a trauma perspective, there's a good chance that they probably have had huge periods of their life when their prefrontal cortex was shut down, since they were under threat that they do not have the capacity to resolve. And so, again, in this state, the ability to learn effective problem-solving skills is highly unlikely and limited. And now I want to say a little bit about the relationship between trauma and mental illness. So, and some of our other presenters will expand on this more. So trauma increases the chances of developing a mental illness. if somebody is predisposed to something, to a certain kind of mental illness, and they have trauma, the chances of them having a mental illness are much greater. I mean, the ACEs study is one study that really documents this very well. So the traumatic events really, contribute to developing mental illness. Having a mental illness that is not properly understood and properly supported will likely lead to a lot of trauma, since a person will go through life trying to navigate many difficulties that are beyond their capacity. And then having a mental illness or being a friend or family member of someone with mental illness, in many cases, is traumatic, especially in this culture. Mental illness is stigmatizing, it's isolating, there's lack of effective treatment, lack of access to services. All of that, contributes to it making it traumatic. Okay, so now I actually want to ask everyone to pause for just a moment and just kind of pause and check in with your body. And I want you to notice your breath, not particularly forcing yourself to breathe in any certain way, but just kind of notice the breath going in and out. And I'm just going to do that for myself for 3 breaths. And now I'm going to ask you to take a breath. And on this last breath, on the exhale, just think about all your muscles just sort of relaxing and just letting go of whatever stress you've been carrying from the day. Okay, so now here's the good news. The good news is that trauma is healable. When we hear the word neuroplasticity, what it means is that the brain has a plastic quality, which means that it can be reshaped if we know how to interrupt the traumatic patterns that have gotten laid down and how to complete those incomplete responses. So there's basically like three, I'm just going to focus on 3 important hallmarks of healing trauma, which are uncoupling, connection, and restoring a sense of agency. So these are the 3 main themes that help us to heal trauma. The first is uncoupling, and what this means is learning to see when past trauma has been triggered. And we uncouple the present situation from the past situation. So the thing is that when trauma occurred, we didn't have the capacity to overcome the threat, which is why we're saying the trauma occurred. But now as adults, we actually do have the capacity to over, if we were to experience that same threat again, we would have the capacity to overcome it. So, for example, a child who grew up in an abusive situation where it was abusive or dangerous, they couldn't leave that situation. They couldn't walk away. The child is completely dependent on their caregivers and does not have a fully developed body or a fully developed brain. They don't have a car or a license or other way to obtain food and shelter. So really, they did not have the capacity to overcome that threat. But as an adult faced with a similar situation, we do have the capacity to overcome threats similar to when we were a child. We can assess situations accurately, so we know, you know, what parts of town not to be in late at night. We can choose who to be around. We can choose to be around safe people. But what happens is that, you know, the memory was laid down of that trauma, and so when that trauma is triggered, we actually experience it, even though we have an adult body, we experience it as if we have a child's body. And so we have to learn ways to recognize our sense of agency, and that what's happening in the present is not what happened in the past. The past is over. And in the present, we actually do have much more skills and much more capacity and many more factors that help us to overcome threat. So the second part of healing trauma is connection. And so connection is a very supportive factor, and lack of connection is what a big contributing factor in trauma. Being alone with a difficult situation. Research has been done showing that during a painful medical procedure, patients report less subjective pain when they have a loved one who is holding their hand during the procedure. So part of healing trauma is strengthening connection, strengthening connection with safe friends, safe family members that we truly feel safe with. But it's also learning how to be one's own best friend, how to deeply attune to our own needs and be patient, gentle, and responsive to ourselves. Another aspect of connection is spiritual connection. In my own work over time, I've come to emphasize more and more helping people to develop their spiritual life, whatever their belief system might be. If spirituality is used skillfully, it is something that can remind us that we are always part of a great mystery, that there is something much bigger than our individual self, and in that we are truly never alone. We can draw great strength from knowing that there is a part of us that is more than our circumstances, and that there are possibilities for strength and wholeness that exist even if we don't see them right now. These are all themes that all great spiritual traditions really help us to see. And then on a purely biological level, the feeling of connection helps us to calm down the more primitive parts of the brain so we can have access to creative problem solving. And the last major part of healing trauma is restoring a sense of agency. And so these are all the ways in which we actually can build capacity to overcome threat. You know, this is building skills, building interpersonal skills, building communication skills. Now, you know, we didn't have these options if we grew up in an environment that was traumatic. We never learned these skills, but now, as an adult, we can learn these skills, awareness skills, self-care skills, also understanding our limits and boundaries, honoring our limits and boundaries. How do we stay within our limits? How to monitor our internal states and reduce our exposure to internal and external stress. So basically, these three last things that I was discussing, the uncoupling, connection, and restoring a sense of agency, these are the prime things that we always want to be moving towards in resolving trauma and healing trauma. And essentially, the very last thing I have to say is, in the most fundamental way, healing trauma is moving from a sense of I can't to a sense of I can. And that's all I have to say. And I'm going to now pass it on to Sue or to Donna, whoever is doing the next.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Lisa. And I wonder if there's any callers with any comments or... Okay, I can say, you know, I actually just went through a one-time trauma when my husband had a fight with the sidewalk and the sidewalk won, and he has a broken shoulder and I'm nursing him. But, you know, at that point, we had no sense of agency. He was on the ground. He was bleeding. He had cut his head, and we were looking for help. And thank goodness, you know, for this physical injury, he had help. And, you know, people who are incarcerated, who have lived through so much trauma, they're not often, you know, offered those needed services to treat trauma. So that's one of the things my organization, FEMI, the Family and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illness, you know, we advocate for those who are justice involved, and most especially for those who are justice involved and are enmeshed within the criminal justice system. So what we want to do is to get them out of jails and prisons. We want to get them into care, health care facilities, comprehensive, that would include the clinical care, the proper psychiatric care, services across the entire spectrum of the legal and justice system. They may not have a broken shoulder, but they may have a broken mind. And, you know, it's my work in this grassroots organization is to, you know, not just to educate and not just to destigmatize and not just to advocate for those services, but I really, you know, my heart says I want to teach people empathy and evoke compassion. So that's one of my goals today. And to learn more about FEMI, you can go to ffmi.blog. And there's a brand new blog out today, which I wrote. And you can contact us if you're interested in FEMI, you know, someone who could help advocate for your loved one if they have serious mental illness and in the justice system. Then you can contact us at ffimi.inquiry@gmail.com. And I just have one question, Lisa. When one can open up, you know, a child who has even, you know, as an adult, I just saw a 2020, a two-part series about someone who couldn't open up about child abuse. And, you know, it because they shame and blame themselves, which is so not earned, you know, and they've been violated, but they can't talk about it. How do they deal with their trauma? If you can't open up, how does one deal with trauma then?
Donna, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I was playing with the mute button. I wasn't sure if it was on or off. You know, the thing about when people can't open up, it's because they don't feel safe enough yet. So what we need to do when we are aware of somebody who's in that situation is how can we provide more safety and more support for that person? Because given enough safety and support, eventually people will open up. And so it's looking for how can we provide more safety?
If they haven't opened up, how do we know they need safety or support? And
well,
sometimes,
they're not opening up.
Yeah, but sometimes you can come from the best of families and, you know, someone just struggles with that.
Struggles with what?
You know, with not being able to open up. Some victims of sexual abuse tend to blame themselves or feel ashamed that they shouldn't feel.
I'm sorry, I missed part of what you said. Who tends to blame themselves?
You know, if there's someone, you know, who maybe have come to adulthood, early adulthood, or even later adulthood. You know, I just watched a documentary of 40-something men, and, you know, who had all been abused by the same man, and they couldn't talk about it for years. And, you know, so how do you know that that person needed support and care?
I see. Well, I guess, you know, probably you, and Sue's probably going to be touching on this, but, you know, probably there are certain signs that, you know, that we see when people aren't engaging socially or people are struggling in being able to effectively live their lives, I'm not exactly sure of what part of that you want me to answer, but I guess that's where we just try to, you know, live our lives with an open heart and be aware of people around us and to, you know, have a sense when we see that people are suffering, you know, that they seem to be carrying a burden. I guess so much depends on the context of where I might encounter that person, you know.
Right. And that's all, you know, that's all well and good, but, you know, sadly, sometimes the services are scarce, you know, which is why I wanted to talk about mental health, because, you know, we have to get more people engaged, more people to care, and more people aware so that there's more parity in the system and there's more services for those with mental health issues.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, it's atrocious, really, the lack of appropriate services that there are. And also it's a new science, really, you know, to really understand trauma, to really understand mental illness. It's like, you know, we don't know as much as there's so much more to learn, you know. And so, you know, we have that too. And then we don't make the best use of the knowledge that we do have about what's effective treatment, you know. So
it's
horrible situation.
Thank you so much. And were you going to say something, Leona?
Yes, I've been listening, and I want to bring up two issues. Right now, we're working with a young man. He's 35, I believe. He is originally from Honduras, I believe it is, but his family have been here since he was a child. He went to all the schools in Massachusetts. And if you go on the internet and type in Marco Flores, he was 17, I believe, and he ended up killing the man that was sexually abusing him. He ended up having a breakdown, and he ended up killing him. So he got 15 years. He's going to be coming out. He's going up for his hearing, and they're planning on deporting him back to his country, but he never lived in that country, so he's been really afraid. So we've been trying to find a way to keep him. His family, his mother lives in Boston, and his family is from the Boston area. But that was a situation when she was talking about, I forgot, what is your first name? Was it Susan that was talking, or was it
Lisa?
Lisa was talking, and everything she was saying brought so many memories back to me, because my own loved one was violated by an in-law, and he ended up, he was resilient all those years. You know, he didn't have a father in his life, and he was a single parent. I was a single parent, but he ended up working, and since the age of 13, he never did drugs or alcohol. He ended up going to prep school in Maine, Bridgeton Academy, and then Springfield College for 4 years. But as you were saying, they're traumatized as children. And he was resilient right up until he was like 22 or 23 years old when something happened. And he ended up doing something as well. And he left the country. But he wanted to be somebody else. He said he didn't want to be himself anymore. So everything that Lisa was talking about, everything Donna, all of you have been talking about, it brings back memories. But at the same time,
I love you, Leona.
It's true. They have to have resources out there for these young people that haven't done anything serious like that yet. They have to have resources for them, and the Department of Mental Health has to get involved before anything happens. And I just wanted to say that, and I'm sorry. I'm going to let you girls go back. I'm going to put myself on mute.
Thank you, Leona. Thank you for sharing something so difficult, so raw. And Leona's such a brave warrior for so many advocates, and I'm getting emotional because I care very deeply for her. And she's a fierce advocate. She cannot help her son because, you know, it's just not a manageable situation that she can help him, you know, get his freedom. And yet she's a fierce advocate day after day, week after week. And like me, we're not really spring chickens, and she's working beyond her retirement to be a voice for those who need it. So, Leona, we're with you. And with that, I'm going to introduce another friend of mine, all friends today, which is awesome. And she was a public school teacher for 25 years in Rhode Island. And I'm sure she had many challenges, and she's a brave, intelligent, and wonderful woman who gave much service. And I'd love to hear all about that and about the challenges. So Sue Cipriano, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Donna. Lisa, that was great. Everything you said, it was very informative. I appreciate that. So I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening and let you know I'm a retired teacher of 25 years. I just retired last year. I taught inner city senior and junior high school students. Okay, many of these students were traumatized for many different reasons. Some came from war-torn countries, abuse, whether it was physical or mentally. There's mental illness in the family that has never been diagnosed. And so these kids come into a classroom and they don't do well because they have so many other things they're thinking of, you know. A lot of them don't even speak English, so they put them in, these kids in a classroom, and we have no idea what is going on with them. We don't have enough staff to handle this. The families sometimes don't understand what a mental illness or trauma is as they have gone through this, and this is how they grew up. So they don't understand that this is, there's something wrong with this child, let's say, because it's just been happening generation after generation. So I think that there should be so many more people involved in children with trauma situations or mental illness. I think teachers, professionals, psychiatrists, social workers, parents, and family members, along with the community, should be involved to help with these kind of children. I think the more advocates these kids have, the better they are at working through this trauma. Also, I think police should be informed if a child or adult has a mental illness, especially, you know, the mental illness part. If you have a medical situation, you have to wear a medical bracelet. So I don't know why a person or a young adult with mental illness couldn't wear a something for the police to know that they have to deal with this person differently. You know, not to, like, put a gun or says mental illness and the person's not talking to you. Maybe they can figure out, oh, maybe this person, you know, has some kind of mental illness. That's why they're not talking. And they look and they see the bracelet on their arm. I think that would be better for everybody. Also, excuse me, children in schools should be diagnosed and treated as early as possible. And usually a teacher knows what's going on with a child. You know, you have 28 kids in a room, especially at the elementary school level. It's a little easier to catch. But once these kids start coming up through the different grades and they come up to junior high and high school and nobody has worked on this trauma situation, it becomes worse and worse and worse for this child to deal. I know that many schools have different organizations that come in to deal with the trauma with these kids, and especially after the COVID-19 and the kids were out of school for a year, there were a lot of things that came back that we didn't have prior. Okay, so way more staff is needed to help these children. I know that yoga is being used in some schools along with mindfulness. A lot of different organizations are coming in to help, so I believe that this can help, but it certainly won't solve the problem of trauma and mental illness. And a big part of it is, like Lisa said, these kids go home and they don't have a choice as to what they go home to. So they could be seeing trauma over and over again. They could be experiencing trauma over and over again, and they have no choice because that's where they have to go. And then they come to school for some kind of, you know, to get away from all of this, and they really don't know how to act. So when Lisa was talking about the three kinds of, can't think of the word, but in class, if a child is having issues, the first thing they will do is, let's say you give an assignment. Okay, they'll try to work with somebody else. Is that, hello? Yes?
Yeah, are you here?
Yes.
I'm here.
Yes, I'm here. Are you here?
I'm here.
I'm here. Okay, are we good?
We're good.
Okay, so in a class, if a child is having trauma issues, okay, first of all, they're not going to want to learn. That's the first thing. They come in, they're not going to want to learn. So if they don't understand the assignment, they'll work with somebody else, which is the social engagement part. And when that doesn't work, the fight or flight response comes in. So the children will not learn because he can't even get it with the social engagement. And this is when the child acts up and will start disturbing the class. And once the teacher has dealt with that, usually the child will just go back and sit at his desk and put his head down, which is a freeze or collapse, because they don't want to work, and they're done. Their mind is just done. So these are the children that grow up not having good problem-solving skills, okay? And they won't be able to deal with real life when they get out of high school, which is a big problem because these kids are graduating and they don't have problem-solving skills. A lot of these kids are extremely angry, and they have a lot of issues, and a lot of it is from trauma. And they get out into the real world, and if that trauma is not dealt with, they don't know how to behave. So another way of dealing with this is having alternative schools addressing these issues that would help these children. They need an appropriate setting to learn in. They need smaller classrooms with the right staff, classes that deal with trauma to help the child, individual counseling and counseling with the parents, and maybe even group counseling within that school setting for other kids who have these issues. In a public school system, they're not going to get what they need to, not all of them, but, you know, some of them, the ones that will slip through the cracks, are not going to get the help they need, and therefore when they get out in the real world, they don't know how. It's very hard for them. It's extremely hard. So I'm hoping that, you know, some of these things will be done to avoid our children coming out of high school and becoming incarcerated because it wasn't taken care of through, you know, school, which it should have been. And I've had kids that have come in with these kind of issues and have succeeded. I have one that's now a teacher with three children, they're almost all grown now. And she's helping kids, she's teaching now at junior high, helping children like she was. I have another child who...
That's great to hear a success story,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, and that's about all I have to say. Does anyone have any questions?
I don't know if we have any callers with questions. Leona, do we have any callers with questions? Okay, I don't hear Leona. But, you know, you made a point that struck me, Sue, and that was there's a need for so many to be involved, teachers, professionals, psychiatrists, social workers, parents and family members, along with the community should be involved to help with any kind of trauma or mental illness. So it's that old, you know, saying that it takes a village. And that's,
right.
You know, that's what I'm fighting for is community involvement. You know, we can all do a little something to help heal this world. You know, it doesn't have to be in the realm of mental illness, but there's so many needs, and we can all do a little something. We need more community. We need more compassion. And you also said to that point, you know, if there's no social engagement for that person in need, then they suffer, and they you know, go downhill in a sense. They don't thrive. So, you know, those are my closing thoughts. And anyone else have any comments?
I'm back again. I have a couple of things I wanted to say. Is the signs to look for in somebody that's been traumatized is that they're very withdrawn. And you mentioned something about social, but they're not into social. They kind of like, even with their friends, they pick out maybe a handful of friends. You can count on their hands. They're very afraid to get involved. So some of the signs to watch for is especially, like, I've seen little girls in the years that I was doing social work, that little girls that had been traumatized. And they were kind of like very quiet. They would always have their heads down, or they'd stick close to their mothers. It, you know, hold on to their mothers. Sometimes it was their own father that was violating them. So mm-hmm. So a lot of times when you see these children that are really, really off to themselves, quiet, withdrawn, even if you mentioned high school, even in high school, if there's signs that they're not as social as the other kids, they're not interacting as the other kids, I think that's another sign that we have to really look at in cases like that. And sometimes they can be very resilient, and one thing can set them off. One more traumatic thing can set them off. And this is why it's so important, too, to try to get that support for them. I wanted to say before, and I forgot, when someone turns 21 years of age and you know that they're severely depressed, they should make it possible for families to be able to put their loved one in a residential treatment facility. And I know you can go to the courts and petition to have them put in a residential facility. But at the same time, it doesn't always happen that way. And they should make it possible when you know that there's a loved one that's seriously depressed or suffering from traumatic experiences, and they're old enough so they don't realize how serious their condition is. That's a problem.
Yeah, and I do have a question because for Sue, because I do like the idea of the bracelet, wearing a medical bracelet, because so many people, you know, have been shot by law enforcement,
right,
because they seem like a threat when they're in
subway.
Psychosis.
But
what about
the
stigma
the
that comes with that?
But would they wear them? That's the other issue.
Yeah, and because of the stigma, they don't, you know, they don't want to be labeled as somebody who's
mm-hmm.
mentally unwell. And then the
right.
other thing is that there's something called anosognosia, which is, you know, a failure to recognize your own mental illness. You don't understand that you have this mental illness. And I work with a lot of families who have loved ones with mental illness. And one family member said something that just stuck with me. And she was telling me that her loved one, you know, didn't recognize or couldn't understand that he was considered mentally ill, because to him it was normal. He had, you know, struggled with this, you know, had this mental illness, these symptoms of mental illness since childhood. And to him it was normal. So he saw it as normal and not recognizable. And Sue, you might have seen that where, you know, people don't recognize it and it almost
mm-hmm.
seems normal to them.
Right. It is. It's a lot of people don't recognize it, won't recognize it, and that's the hardest part. If you're a kid or a child and you have some kind of trauma or whatever, and the parents won't agree with you, then there's nothing you can do. You know, because the child they're a child.
Right.
So that's an issue too.
Yes. So with that, you know, I'd like to introduce our next guest.
One more question. Can
sure.
I ask one more question? I just wanted to ask Sue, you know, you mentioned this one person who, student who went on to become a teacher and to, you know, work with people kind of like, you know, how she was when she was a kid. I was wondering if you have any sense of what enabled her to do that. Like, what was it that helped her to overcome?
Well, she had a lot of support. She had myself and my family, who were a huge support. She wasn't a dummy. You know, she was a smart girl, and she did well in school. And she just, you know, she overcame it. She had a lot of help and a lot of, she belonged to a church, and just she had a lot of people helping her to get through this. And she did. And so did her sister. So, yeah, it's a nice story. And, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
I love the success stories, and sometimes, you know, unfortunately, they're so rare that they feel like a miracle, but I welcome every and each miracle that we get. So my next guest is Annette Burke, again, a good friend of mine, a great communicator, and she is also affiliated. She's been a huge help and support system to FEMI, my grassroots organization, and I'll just reiterate that one more time, that we're an advocacy group focused on providing a voice for people with serious mental illness in the criminal justice system. And what we feel is justice is that, people with an illness deserve comprehensive and compassionate health care. So, Annette has aligned herself with FEMI. She's been active in different advocacy groups. She's been active in her own community with the local police department, helping to educate them. And I'm very proud to introduce Annette Burke. And she's going to be talking basically about prevention and you know, maybe in early childhood and onwards. So, Annette, thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, Donna. I appreciate that. And it's an honor to be back. I'm so happy that I'm able to support FEMI, and I will continue to do so for as long as I can. So I just want to talk a little bit about preventative care and why it's so important. As Sue and Lisa, you know, talked about trauma, and how it's impacting school-age children, this is where I see the biggest opportunity to help prevent mental illness from rising. And, you know, our world is changing in so many ways. The residual effects of COVID and major stresses in everyone's lives, the need for mental health services is greater than ever. We're at the height of what the system can handle today. There's a continued shortage of providers, services, and facilities. We're seeing a huge increase in early school children suffering from anxiety, depression. They're struggling in school. There's bullying. They're so disconnected from society that if we don't fix this problem now, it's just going to continue to grow and grow and grow. Our emergency rooms are so at capacity. They just can't handle the volume of people that are coming in seeking help. And we have parents, we have guardians that just don't know what to do. They're noticing something different. It's recommended that their child see a therapist or go to a counselor, but then there's no one around that can help them. There's a lack of clinicians, therapist. There's such a huge, long wait list, and no one should have to wait weeks, months, years to see a therapist or a counselor. That should not happen. It's boarding in emergency rooms. That's just become the norm. If you go to an emergency room, expect to be there for several days or weeks before you can even possibly be put on a list to be admitted to an inpatient facility. And a lot of times there can be some type of support provided in an emergency room where that individual can go home with their parents and maybe seek other services. But there are a lot of people that have just suffered for so long, have so much trauma or so much built up in them that they need to be inpatient. And there's such the lack of beds. It's just not there. If they're lucky enough to be admitted to a hospital, it's usually for 2 weeks. 2 weeks is not enough to really get to the root cause of the problem and help rehabilitate someone back into the community. And that's why, like Donna said, we need a village help. We need community involvement. We need clinicians. We need doctors. We need family. We need friends. Everyone has to rally together to help an individual and, you know, help them become successful back into the community. But if we don't start early, it's going to continue to grow. And we need more services in place to help. Group homes. There are group homes out there, but a lot of them are not dedicated just to behavioral health. A lot of them are dual-purpose group homes. Most of them are full. There's a long wait list to get in. And if you don't have the capacity to take care of an individual at home, they're not able to be an inpatient or get into a group home, 9 out of 10 times they become homeless. They're living on the street. And we're seeing such a rise in so many homeless people suffering from mental health conditions. And they didn't choose to be homeless. They didn't choose to be mentally ill. This is something that's happened, and it's progressed over the years. So we really need to pull together some better services to help before it becomes more and more out of control. And one of the things that I personally would love to see is a residential living facility for those with behavioral health or mental illness, and a living facility similar to senior housing or senior living facility, a place where someone can live at, be independent, but still have some services, daily routines, guidance, and clinical support as needed. But, you know, there's just not enough. There's not enough places that we can offer those struggling with mental health, and that's why they become more and more ill. And that's when something tragic starts to happen. It's, you know, no one should have to be admitted through the court system. And, you know, the courts, a lot of times when someone is admitted through the court system, something severe has already happened. The court systems are overcrowded. There's a huge lack of support that's lacking there. And if they're forced to be admitted, the outcome is not always going to be the best. Most are sent to jails or correctional centers, and that can cause more and more trauma. That can just continue to add layer of trauma, because those suffering with mental illness don't belong in the jail system. They don't belong in the general population with those that don't have mental illness, because those with mental illness are very vulnerable. They need more compassionate therapeutic care, and jails cannot provide that. So we really need to find a way to help when someone is brought in through the court system, and, you know, they need to be filtered out into a better place where they can get the better support and help rather than just be thrown into a correctional center. DMH in Massachusetts is the Department of Mental Health, and you know they're a great organization, but they also their hands are tied with all political guidelines. They have facilities, they have great services, they have great programs, but you know sadly not everyone can qualify to be a patient in a Department of Mental Health facility or to get services through the Department of Mental Health. So I would love to see more offered through that and, you know, be able to bring the Department of Mental Health into correctional facilities, into jails, and help those that are suffering with mental illness. You know, there's many times that we see news stories or read about tragic events causing harm to others, death or suicide. You know, how many times do we have to hear the same story over and over and over and nothing is done about it? There's so much happening in our communities that we want to hear more positive outcomes. We want to hear something positive coming out of a situation. But a lot of times that story fades away and nothing is done to prevent tragedy from happening again. We really need to make mental health a priority in our country. We need to make changes now to stop the destruction. We need educational programs. We need better compassionate and therapeutic care and to bring awareness. To the illness. We need to educate at an early level. And it does need to start at school age because that's where the suffering, the trauma, the illness starts to happen and it grows, it manifests. And if we don't stop it, if we don't help prevent it from getting worse, it's gonna take over. So, you know, we really need more compassionate care. We need more clinicians. We need more doctors. There's school resource officers in some communities that work with the children. They bring in the therapy dogs. That's just something that should be in all schools. If we can educate at an early age, if we can have the resource officers in the schools making connections, then they get to know the children. They get to interact with them in the schools as they grow into the community, and they will get to know, is this person someone that may need some extra support? Police departments are trained in the crisis intervention program. This is a program that, again, should be extended in all communities. There's co-clinicians that will respond to a call with the police if needed. And, you know, when there's a call for a mental health crisis or a domestic call, if a clinician can assist the police in that call, it just makes it so much better. There's more compassion, there's more understanding, and there's de-escalation that helps. I really feel that if we work together in the community, if we can work with our legislators and help make changes, then, you know, we will start to see things get better. I've talked to, you know, a lot of people, and I constantly hear them say, yeah, the system is broken. What are you going to do? And that's where I say, well, there is something you can do. You know, you can write to your legislators. You can speak up. You can write a letter asking them to help support bills that are waiting to be passed or help provide and offer more services in communities. Our legislators hold the key You know, there's a lot more that they can do, but we as the people have to speak up. If we don't speak up and let our legislators know how it's impacting us, the community, you know, they're not going to do anything about it. So, you know, I challenge everyone to write to their legislators, send them an email, a text, call them and ask them to help. Ask them to support the laws, bills waiting to be passed and help change the system, because that's the only way we're going to get things done. If, you know, we just sit back and wait for someone else to do it, no one's going to do it. So we need more people to bring awareness to mental health. Mental health doesn't just affect the person. It affects the entire family dynamic. Everybody suffers through the process. Everyone suffers through the journey and even after. And for some, it's a devastating illness that can last a lifetime. It may not end. And if we don't learn how to treat it, work with it, respond to it, it's going to get worse and worse. So I really, you know, we need to find ways to break the cycle, and we need more services. One of the things that I've also noticed is that there's more attention being drawn to mental health in recent TV shows, movies, documentaries, and it's bringing more awareness to the illness in everyday life. There's more actors, musicians, athletes, public figures that are speaking out. And, you know, the more people speak out, the more public figures or someone that, you know, kids look up to speak out and admit that, hey, I suffer from depression, I suffer from anxiety. That doesn't mean that I can't be successful. That's something that will help our youth. And if you know, those are successful, that will encourage those to want to get help, want to be more productive. And, you know, eliminating that stigma and letting them know it's okay not to be okay and that you still can be productive. Success stories happen. They're out there. But a lot of people don't want to admit their illness. They don't want to talk about how they feel. So getting more and more talk about how they feel. I love how Lisa spoke about holistic care. Holistic care is something that you can do every day with meditating, yoga, self-care. We all need that. And, you know, if we can just bring a little bit of that into our lives and help those that may be on the edge of anxiety, of depression before it gets worse, you know, that's an easy thing that someone can do. But it's working with that person. So I think that if we all take a part, if we reach out to our legislators, then, you know, we can create change. And we need to get more involved. There's a lot of resources out there to take advantage of. NAMI is, you know, they're the nationwide and easy to find online. There's a 988, that's the toll-free call 24/7 to support. There's BetterHelp is a new organization that they offer online. Psychology Today is a great online resource tool where you can find doctors, therapist in your area. There's a site called The Mighty that you can connect with other people that are suffering and struggling with mental health, and you can share stories. There's local community pages that we can connect with for resources within our own community. Credible Minds is another great site. And, you know, these are all links that I can send to Donna and Leona, and then we can add them to the page. So if anyone wants to look them up, they can. But, you know, we also want to work with the legislators and ask them to really help the most important bill that's currently in legislation is to transfer Bridgewater State Hospital to the Department of Mental Health. That is something that we have been trying to do for years. It's needed so desperately because DMH is the expert. They have the resources, they have the tools, they have the education to help those with severe mental illness. Bridgewater State Hospital is run by the Department of Corrections, and the Department of Corrections is in the business of running jails, and those that are in Bridgewater State Hospital, they need more therapeutic, compassionate care that DMH can offer. And this is something that's very close to my heart because I do know someone that are in Bridgewater State Hospital, and they deserve better. So if we can get that bill passed, reach out to Representative Ruth Bosler and, you know, let her know that you support the bill and your own legislators, let's make that happen. That would be a blessing to help all of those in that facility. And, you know, I just want to say thank you for listening. I hope you found all of this helpful today. I learned a lot from Lisa. I learned a lot too, also today. So I appreciate you speaking as well. God bless you all. Stay strong in the journey because there is light ahead. Always stay humble and never give up. Donna, I'll send it back to you.
Thank you so much, Annette. That was beautifully said. And isn't it interesting? Here we're five women, and we've intersected so well in the work that we're doing. I know, you know, we have Lisa with a background in trauma as a trauma specialist, and then we have Sue, who's been a teacher and has had that experience and education of working with people with mental illness. And then there's Annette, and Annette has had a professional business background. And we have Leona with her social work background, and I was a fine arts appraiser. So we have different backgrounds, and yet we've all intersected on this level of caring about those with mental illness. And, you know, there's so many of us to care, but the system is so hard to break down, and sometimes you have to wonder why. But one of the happy successes of FIMI, the Family and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illness, is that we have worked with some of the sheriffs and superintendents. We've worked with all of them, but three of them stand out. Superintendent David Tuttle of the Worcester County Jail, all on his own initiative, built a small building, but he built a specific facility at the jail for people with serious mental illness. He hired within his own budget, beyond what was provided to him through the Department of Corrections, and he hired the best clinicians he could find. They're amazing, and they're giving compassionate care. So he's our number one star. He was my first contact. And then we met with the sheriffs and the president of the Sheriff Association, Carrie Hill, and she's been wonderful with working with FIMI. And two of the jails have stepped up and actually gave us credit. Those sheriffs gave FIMI credit at the State House testimony to the legislators this past December. But what they did was they built specific mental health units so that these people with mental illness are not just thrown in incarceration with no help for their trauma, with no help for the disease they didn't choose, but they're actually given that clinical and psychological care. And I absolutely know one of the persons who's such a success story and you know, at home now and doing very well, and it just warms my heart, and we just need more of that. So what we're talking about is not mental illness per se. What we're talking about is that we all can step up and help one another. Support is crucial. Compassion is crucial. We've got to, Sue said it best, the person who succeeded and became a teacher had lots of support. So we have to support others. We have to support the supporters. So, you know, even if we're infirm and we can't do much, we can support the supporters, you know, be willing to, you know, see that our taxes, maybe advocate a little bit that our taxes are spent on services that are needed. And with that said, I'd like Leona to talk about her upcoming June event and ways that we can reach out. And Annette was great at saying how much we need to connect with the legislators. I've been advocating fiercely, you know, in the advocacy realm for 9 to 10 years, before that for 15 since the onset of my grandson's mental illness. But, you know, Leona's got a plan for June, and I'd like for her to speak about it.
Donna, before Leona speaks, could I just also add that, you know, we should not have to wait for something tragic to happen before someone gets help.
I didn't
speak about this, but, you know, just a quick example of a young man who suffered a traumatic event 10 years ago, early 8th grade, 9th grade. He couldn't go to school. He dropped out of school. The school didn't care. They just let him go. He was in and out of hospitals. The family did everything they could to get him help, support. Doors were just constantly closed. He was begging for help. COVID hit, more doors closed. ERs were packed, no therapists, lack of services. You know, sadly, the only way that he was able to get help was to get arrested. You know, he was arrested for a minor offense, sent to Bridgewater State Hospital for an evaluation where he was held for 9 months before he was released to the Department of Mental Health facility. And, you know, it wasn't until he was released to that facility that the Department of Mental Health was able to work with him and get him the help and support that he desperately needs. It took 10 years, an arrest, and trauma on top of trauma for him to finally get help. The school failed him, the system failed him, society failed him. He's doing so well right now under the care of the Department of Mental Health, and I really want to credit them because, you know, they finally were able to give this boy back part of his life and not give up on him. And, you know, that's just one of tens of thousands of stories. And this is why I'm really passionate about getting preventative care out there early on, because no one should have to suffer that way. No child, no parent, no one should have to see their child suffer that way and be penalized for being mentally ill. And, you know, those that are, you know, sent to jails, correctional centers, they're penalized for their illness. And that really bothers me, because it shouldn't happen. If they had the right care in the beginning, if they were given the right services, or there was that one person that didn't give up on them in the beginning, they would not have ended up where they were. So, you know, this is why I feel preventative care is so important. And I'll just stop there.
And that was great. And MapNet is an organization, you could look it up. MapNet is an organization that tries to help children at the first psychosis. And then what I really got excited about is that they, you know, not only help at that first psychosis, but they work to connect the system, because resources can be fractured and hard to obtain. So what they do is that they, you know, try to find that continuum of care. And that's what we need, is a continuum of care across time for a long ongoing disease. And that's, you know, that's the goal of FEMI. So Annette, thank you for summing that up. And Leona,
that was
would you
beautiful.
Love to talk about your June event.
Yes, that was beautiful what Annette just said. And I was going to say, Donna, years ago when my son was going through what he was going through, Bill Bodio, he worked with the South Bay Mental Health. I haven't seen him for years, but I remember talking to him about the depression my son was in at the time, and he offered to actually, you know, take my son out, go for a soda or something and talk to him. He called the house, but my son, again, they don't know when they're seriously depressed, they don't know that they're, how serious their sickness is, as you mentioned and the girls mentioned earlier. So he didn't know this man, and he said no. He said thank you, but no thank you. But if you can find what Bill Bodio is doing now, wherever he may be, he worked for South Bay Mental Health at the time, but I'm sure he's not with them now. But if you can connect with him on the bill that you're talking about, I think he would be a big supporter if he's still around. Bill Bodio. And
I'll look him up.
And is with the Department of Mental Health, I remember there was a young man in Hyannis on the Cape that he had a mental illness, and if he didn't take his medication, he was all over the place. But when anybody would call to get help for him, they would say they couldn't do anything unless he did something, you know, dangerous. But I don't know whatever happened to that young man. He was tall, and he was very sickly if he didn't take his meds. But the program, the event we're having in June is we're going to be doing mass calls, letter writing, and emailing to the media, to the United Nations, to the legislative members, to the governors in every state in the United States. And we're going to be addressing a lot of the things that are going on in this country, injustices behind the prison walls as well as in the communities. So whatever your issues are, whatever it is that you're going to be calling or writing or emailing about, let everybody know. Post it on social media and let us know. I've been posting the contact information, the emails. I've been posting to the major media outlets, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, all of these stations, NPR, PBS. But I've been posting all these addresses, and others that are participating are also putting everything together. So everyone will have that information on social media, and all they have to do is call these numbers. Even if you just leave a message on the voicemails, even if you just speak with the receptionist, just bombard these people, because the media needs to get more involved as well. They need to talk more about these issues. And until these things happen, we're going to have a difficult time. So call in the media and let them know about the bill that's coming out that you spoke of, Donna, and please let me know, and I will get that all over the place too.
I will. The bill, there, it's actually two-pronged, and H. dot for the House, H2985, is an act transferring Bridgewater State Hospital from the Department of Correction to the Department of Mental Health. And that is sponsored by a wonderful champion, Representative Ruth Balzer, who is a psychologist. And then neck and neck with that, pretty similar, there's a bill F-1239, and that's in the Senate, and that's an act to transfer Bridgewater State Hospital from the Department of Corrections to the Department of Mental Health, and that's Senator Cindy Cream. So those are that and Senator Friedman's bill, not guilty but with mental illness, so that, you know, a sentence can be, if someone is found guilty for a crime committed under, you know, the psychosis of mental illness, they will be sent, you know, to a secured facility, health care facility, mental health facility. So those are the two priorities of FEMI as far as legislation. So we've been working very hard with these champions and these champion legislators. There really are champions out there who care about our issues. Senator Jamie Eldridge, Representative Michael Day, you know some of them. There's Lindsay Sabadosa. There's quite a few, and it's gaining. However, we need enough legislators on board to you know, to get it pushed forward and make it happen.
That's awesome. Yeah. That is, you know, this was a very, very interesting show you girls put on. I loved it. I loved you're experienced, you're knowledgeable, and it was just an honor to listen to all of you.
Hello. I think we got cut off. Oh,
so
okay.
Did everybody give their contact information to the audience?
Is there anyone who wants to give contact information?
Sure, I can give my email address.
So this is Lisa Bellotta.
Yes. And my email address is lisabellotta10@gmail.com. So LISA, B as in boy, ILOTTA, 10, gmail.com. And I'm happy to, receive emails and respond if there's any follow-up questions that people have or referrals that I can make for support.
Thank you so much. You girls are awesome. And Sue, I 25 years experience. You said it today, Donna and Annette. Thank you so much. I enjoyed listening to you, and Donna, you did an excellent job hosting. I'm going to have you do it.
Oh, thank you. I'm not quite the pro you are, but I really enjoyed doing it. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you, and I guess we'll be closing now.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Leona. Thank you. We appreciate you, Leona.
Thank you, Donna. Donna, I hope you'll have all of them on again, because you girls, this is what is needed. And I say this all the time. We have an epidemic in this country of mental illnesses and addictions. And I found that a lot of addictions, a lot of the addictions even, are from traumatized individuals who have turned to alcohol and drugs to block out all the pain and suffering they went through.
Self-medicate.
And so these discussions are very important to get out there and to get anyone involved and everyone involved. And maybe to even bombard the Department of Mental Health to get them more involved in what's going on in the prisons. So thank you, girls, again. And we're going to be closing. Donna, let me know when you plan to do this again. I'd love to be on. I'd love to listen. And I'd also love to get other people to listen in on this.
Great. And I was thinking, you know, if these women come on again, we could, you know, rather than each have a monologue, we'll change it up next time and we can interact with each other, because I saw a lot of intersection and, you know, they were just all three phenomenal. I'm very honored to have them as my friends. I'm very honored to have them as speakers today. So I hope they come again.
I want to, one last thing, on May 24th, I believe it's next Wednesday, I will be interviewing, his name is Franz Dopp, and he is from Amsterdam. He's a warden, he was a 27-year warden, and he's been in the Massachusetts prisons, he's been in the New York prisons, and he's still working with the advocates out of Texas. He's going to be coming on to discuss the comparison between the prisons in Amsterdam and in the European countries in comparison to mass incarceration in the United States. Miriam Jacobs, the psychosocial therapist, will also be joining him. So this will be next Wednesday, and that will be at 12 o'clock our time, 6 o'clock their time. Jan Banning will also be coming on. Jan Banning is a professional photographer in the Netherlands, but he's also been advocating for a Christina Boyle, who is a wrongfully convicted female in Georgia. And I believe he's supposed to be coming on, I think it's tomorrow, to tell you the truth, and it will be at 12 o'clock.
Great, and I can pass that information on for you to my two advocacy groups.
Okay, and again, Donna, thank you so much, Lisa, Susan, and Sue, and Annette. Thank you all for being on. We're going to be ending this episode now. Thank you, audience, for listening in. Thank you, girls.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.